This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, February 28th, 2018. And hey, if you like this podcast, subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating while you're there. That really helps us out. Enjoy the show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And to start today, we bring you a message from the National Rifle Association.
Swimming is fun for anybody. But since some of us aren't exactly Olympic champs, signs are posted telling where it's safe to play. Shooting, too, is fun. That's why it's the favorite sport of millions of people. And like swimming, it's a safe sport, so long as we know what we're doing.
That was 72 years ago, 1946. Today, well, today, the NRA sounds a bit different.
I know you're watching, so pay attention. You hate my freedom, my religion, and my country.
You and I didn't choose to be targets in the age of terror, but innocents like us will continue to be slaughtered in concert halls, sports stadiums, restaurants, and airplanes.
We will never see a day for the rest of our lives where that threat doesn't hover above our heads.
We're going to Fisk, the New York Times, and find out just what deep rich means to this old gray hag.
But you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland.
No amount of bloodshed will ever satisfy the demons among us.
The transformation of the National Rifle Association hasn't just been a reaction to American conservative politics. It's helped to shape it, and it tells us a lot about the nature of the gun debate that we're having right now in the United States. A growing list of corporations have decided that they don't want to be associated with the messages you just heard there anymore. In a few minutes, a Republican candidate for governor in Georgia reacts and says he's ready to get even with Delta Airlines for ending a discount program for NRA members. But first, the NRA of yesterday and today. Adam Winkler is a professor at UCLA Law School and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And he brings us back to the very beginning.
The NRA was begun right after the Civil War by some Union soldiers who thought that the Union had just been outfought by the Confederacy because of a lack of training with firearms, and that we needed to better train the civilians so that the next time there's a war, they could be well trained to defend the nation. But the NRA has changed a lot in the years since, although mostly supporting gun control, at least moderate measures, for most of its history. In the last 40 years or so, it's really turned more extreme.
Well, that's sort of the post-Civil War era, the dawn of the NRA. What about the 20th century? What did the NRA become at that time, in the 20s and 30s, in the pre-war period? And what kinds of policies did they push for?
In the 1920s and 30s, the NRA was a leading gun violence prevention group and, in fact, was behind a nationwide push to restrict who could carry guns on the public streets. The NRA testified in favor of the first federal gun control law, the National Firearms Act of 1934, that banned certain kinds of weapons. And the NRA, after the Civil War, represented a lot of hunters and outdoors activities. They always believed that people should have firearms in the home for personal protection. But they supported reasonable gun control laws, including the Gun Control Act of 1968.
The National Rifle Association has fought long and hard for practical and for sensible gun laws aimed in the right direction. To keep guns out of the hands of the criminal, the juvenile, the mental misfit, the dope addict, the habitual drunkard. The National Rifle Association does not want these people to have guns.
Well, when did things start to change?
Things started to change in the NRA after the Gun Control Act of 1968. The leadership was very moderate and plotted a move to close up the Washington office, retreat from political activity, and move to Colorado Springs to focus on outdoors activities and hunting. This angered a group of hardliners in the membership who thought guns were more about shooting criminals who were coming to get you in a time of rising crime rates than guns were for shooting ducks. And in 1977, the hardliners staged a coup where they took over the organization literally overnight at the annual membership meeting in Cincinnati.
Only life members can vote at conventions. And at the last convention, they were able to vote out the former leadership, which was suspected of having gone soft on the gun control issue. Harlan Carter was voted back in command. The vote gave warning to gun control advocates in Congress that the hardliners were back in charge of the NRA.
take the guns away from the American citizen, this country will go communist just like Russia or any of your others. It's been a proven fact through history.
The group of people who took over the NRA, including Harlan Carter, who is the leader of the insurgents.
Any national gun law, no matter how innocent in appearance, presupposes a still further growth in a centralized, computerized gun control bureaucracy in Washington, D.C.
We're really dedicated to an anti-gun control version of the Second Amendment, a view that was very extreme, that opposed most forms of gun control, and thought that the main mission of the NRA was not in promoting marksmanship or outdoors activity, but in fighting for gun rights. If we wanted to find one date in American history where not only the gun debate changed, but so much else changed in American politics, in part because of the strength of the gun debate, we'd look at that annual membership meeting in 1977.
Thanks to you, the members and supporters of NRA, no national gun law has passed this year. We will stand together, strong, dedicated, shoulder to shoulder, for what is right.
And what about after that? The high crime of the 1980s, a lot of the political rhetoric at the time was around fear of criminals, no politician wanting to be soft on crime. There was a lot of fear in America. There was a lot of fear in white America, to be frank. Did the NRA's politics track with that climate of fear?
Absolutely. One of the reasons the NRA has been around since 1871 is that it really evolves and changes with the demographics of gun owners. And so after World War II, the NRA was all about hunting because that's where people were using their guns. In the 1970s and 80s, when you have these starkly rising crime rates, you do see the NRA refocus its rhetoric on self-defense against criminals.
The following is a message from the National Rifle Association.
Hello, I'm Charlton Heston, actor, sportsman, and gun collector. This week, President Bill Clinton signed into law the Brady Bill, mandating a 5-day waiting period for the purchase of a simple handgun. The only problem is, while you're waiting for your gun, the criminals are stealing theirs and running amok.
And that really dominates the rhetoric until just recently, where we've seen what was an extreme view of the Second Amendment, that it's about fighting tyranny and so people can revolt against the government in arms. That's become a more central theme of the NRA just recently.
Well, let's talk about the mid-90s then, because it seems like that's when a lot of that new rhetoric came online. Wayne LaPierre, the executive vice president of the NRA, was around back then, who in 1995, in a mailer, I believe, made the famous comment that jackbooted government thugs are coming for your guns. That seemed like an important moment.
That was an important moment because, as I said, there's been a fringe view of the Second Amendment that focuses on fighting government tyranny. It was occasional comments like that one that Wayne LaPierre made back in 1995, but he was swiftly rebuked. Former President George H.W. Bush resigned his NRA membership after that incident, and Wayne LaPierre refocused on self-defense arguments for the Second Amendment until just recently.
A lot of analysts have commented that the NRA wasn't really a captive of the right, that in many ways the NRA helped invent the modern political far right.
The NRA was very much a central coalition partner in the rise of the new right.
To the Ayatollahs of Iran and every terrorist you enable, you might have met our fresh-faced flower child president and his weak-kneed Ivy League friends, but you haven't met America. You haven't met the heartland, where the people will defend this nation with their bloody, calloused, bare hands. And you ought to pray you never do. I'm the National Rifle Association of America.
Although the NRA is officially nonpartisan and has a history of supporting Democrats who supported strong views of the Second Amendment, that's really changed increasingly. And the NRA, especially if you check out its recent NRA TV, you really see an adoption of a much more extreme anti-left view of not only the Second Amendment, but of all sorts of government policies.
This is what liberal leadership gets you. No responsibility, no accountability. We've got people dead from Benghazi. We've got people dead at Parkland. And liberal leadership is at the height of all of it.
And it's strange that we see an increasing amount of rhetoric about how people are coming to take your guns, even though over the last 30 years, you've really seen the gun control movement moderate. And whereas it once supported broad bans on civilian gun ownership, now they're talking about regulating bump stocks and just trying to get universal background checks. No one's talking about taking away handguns or eliminating civilian ownership of guns. But yet that's what the NRA's emphasis has really become.
So much of the NRA's messaging today, when you watch it, doesn't really mention guns at all at times. It certainly mentions the left and liberals and big government and people wanting to destroy the Constitution and take away your rights. Sometimes it doesn't mention the guns themselves at all.
That's right. We're seeing increasingly the NRA is just focusing on the culture wars. For instance, Wayne LaPierre's statement the other day at CPAC was focused on Marxists and leftists and anarchists and socialists who were teamed up with the left to destroy America and take away everyone's rights. Wasn't even focused on the Second Amendment.
Obama promised a fundamental transformation of our country. And you know what? It began with his own national party. A party that is now infested with saboteurs who don't believe in capitalism, don't believe in the Constitution, don't believe in our freedom, and don't believe in America as we know it.
Dana Loesch, when she made that very well-known video that went viral some months ago, wasn't even about gun policy. It was about how people were rising up in violence against the NRA and the right.
They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, bully and terrorize the law-abiding. The only way we save our country and our freedom is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
So we are seeing a real change and shift in the NRA's rhetoric. It's becoming a much more political organization rather than a gun organization.
We're jumping around in history a little bit, Adam, but let me take you back to 2000 and a famous comment from a famous man, NRA president at the time, Charlton Heston.
So as we set out this year to defeat the divisive forces that would take freedom away, I want to say those fighting words for everyone within the sound of my voice to hear and to heed, and especially for you, Mr. Gore. From my cold, dead hands.
That applause line at the NRA convention, Adam Winkler, echoed throughout the culture. You still hear it today, almost a political cliche in American life. When you hear that old Charlton Heston cut, what do you think about?
Well, that was a really important moment in the gun debate because Al Gore was expected to win that presidential election. The economy was doing well, and he ended up losing, and losing in part because he lost his home state of Tennessee. And all analysts believe that the gun issue was an important issue. He had taken a strong stand in favor of some new gun control measures. And I think that was a moment where the NRA really exercised its political power. It motivated a lot of voters. And here's the key to the NRA. We think about the NRA as a powerhouse because of its money, but its real power comes not just from the money, but from the voters that get swayed by people like Charlton Heston.
Adam, let's talk about gun manufacturers. How important are they really to the NRA now? I mean, it is a membership organization. You said that more important than their lobbying money is the political marching orders they can imbue to their members, essentially. Many analysts have basically branded the NRA as a front group for firearms manufacturers, saying that their policies reflect the profit motives of manufacturers and little more. But is that an accurate picture of what the NRA is?
It's an incomplete picture because certainly the NRA has a very close symbiotic relationship with the gun industry. Their magazines are supported by advertisements by gun makers and gun accessory makers. But I don't think that's the full picture. You have to understand that there's a lot of single-issue pro-gun voters who think of this issue in cultural terms, lifestyle terms. They're supporting gun rights not because they love big gun makers. They support gun rights because they think it's really essential to their identity. And that's the real strength of the NRA, I think.
Adam, there's a script that we've become accustomed to after a mass shooting like Las Vegas or San Bernardino or Parkland or Sutherland Springs. Describe how the NRA operates now when a mass shooting occurs with, let's say, an assault weapon and all eyes in America turn to the NRA for a response.
Well, usually the NRA takes the approach of silence right after some kind of mass shooting because they know that's not a favorable time for the NRA to be engaged in a debate over gun policy. And so they usually say it's an inappropriate time to talk about gun shootings. But of course, there's so many mass shootings that there's really not much time between them to have that kind of conversation. What's happened is in some recent incidents, and especially this Parkland shooting, the NRA has felt compelled to fight back, to defend itself. And so we saw that with Dana Loesch making her comments at the CNN town hall and the CPAC speech by Wayne LaPierre. I think in part because the NRA is seeing that there's actually a little bit of momentum shifting in the gun debate. I don't expect we'll see the NRA moderate its position in any significant way, but we are seeing new political energy and mobilization on the gun violence prevention side. You know, the politics of the gun debate have been very one-sided for a long time. While 90% of the people say they support background checks, it's the 10% that oppose it that are those NRA loyalists who vote on that basis, who organize, get their friends to vote, are really politically active. What we're seeing now is more mobilization on those who favor more restrictive gun laws. And that could really change the gun debate, including making some elected officials bend.
Well, given the contours of this debate now, Adam, let's talk about a future, maybe an imaginary future, where the NRA decides that it's in its best interest to soften its position on some form of gun control, maybe background checks, I don't know. It seems to me that if they ever decided that, it could be nearly impossible to achieve because once you've participated in the politics of telling people their freedom is at stake, it's pretty hard to go back on that and preach compromise at any point.
I think it does make it difficult. The NRA has really painted itself into a corner. But I will say this. I think the forces that wish for more restrictive gun control laws will take whatever they can get. If the possibility of compromise leads to legislation, gun control forces will be satisfied with that. And the NRA will always be able to count on a group of very diehard gun enthusiasts who will follow the NRA whichever direction it goes.
Adam Winkler, professor at UCLA Law School, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, today the NRA has millions of politically active members. And we asked you, the NRA members listening, to tell us what the organization means to you.
Hi, my name is Bill from San Angelo, Texas. I'm a recent NRA Life member, retired military veteran, and I grew up in a country where guns were a fundamental part of my childhood. I'm very saddened when anyone is murdered, whether it's with a gun or otherwise. I'm also willing to listen to any solution that is likely to be successful, as long as it is sound and does not infringe on our gun rights.
This is Wyatt from Crowley, Texas. In light of all the demonization of NRA members and the NRA itself, I decided to join the NRA for the first time. The NRA is a lobbyist organization that represents my rights and the rights of millions of law-abiding gun owners. And further demonization of them will only bolster our ranks.
This is Nina from Weymouth. No, I am not an NRA member. My husband used to be, and he got so disgusted with the organization that he stopped paying his dues and is no longer a member.
Hi, my name's Brennan Wells from Colorado Springs, Colorado. I'm an NRA member and have been for about the last 10 years, but a large part of that is because I'm also a Boy Scout firearms instructor. I teach rifle and pistol and shotgun to the boys, and one of the requirements is an active NRA instructor membership. So they have one of the finest and most effective education programs regarding the safe use and handling of firearms.
Yeah, this is Ken Winterberger from Anchorage, Alaska, and I was a longtime member of the NRA while they really were a safety, gun safety, and marksmanship organization, when they started to get into politics, and they went over the top, and I dropped my membership.
Hi, my name is Jeanette, and I currently live in Ogden, Utah. So my concern with the NRA refers to my father. He bought lifetime memberships for every member of our family, including my granddaughter as a newborn. So I wonder what the numbers of true NRA membership is, because like I said, my granddaughter, from the time she was born, was a lifetime member of the NRA.
Now, for some of you who called in, the NRA isn't about politics or lobbying or making a stand on the Second Amendment. Instead, it's about education.
I'm a very active Democrat, liberal. I'm an NRA member. I'm an NRA certified safety instructor for rifle, pistol, and shotgun. I run shooting events for women. I wasn't anti-gun before I ever got a gun or went shooting or anything, but I did think negatively of the NRA, but not after I went to them to look at instruction, because I realized that they're the only ones out there who are doing this training, that are promoting the safety.
This is The Takeaway. Since the Parkland shooting in Florida, some corporations have cut their business and marketing ties to the National Rifle Association. MetLife, First National Bank of Omaha, Avis and Budget, Hertz and Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and United Airlines. But when Delta Airlines said that it too would stop offering deals and discounts for NRA members, the blowback was swift. Delta has a hub and a lot of jobs in Atlanta, Georgia, and Georgia Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle tweeted this: "I will kill any tax legislation that benefits Delta unless the company changes its position and fully reinstates its relationship with the NRA. Corporations cannot attack conservatives and expect us not to fight back." Well, it's a political time in Georgia. Cagle is running for governor in the Republican primary, where conservatives are the kingmakers. And the tax cut he's pledging to kill, it's a $40 million jet fuel exemption for Delta, currently making its way through the Georgia Assembly. Georgia Republican State Senator Michael Williams represents Forsyth County, north of Atlanta. He's also running for governor in the state's GOP primary. Senator, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Todd. It's a pleasure.
Do you agree with that tweet that I just read from your opponent and your colleague, Casey Cagle?
Well, Todd, I have to be honest with you. I chuckle every time I hear that, because I was fighting this tax exemption for Delta on Friday when he was trying to fast-track it through the Senate. It was me and another senator there. We actually attempted to take that measure out of a tax break for the rest of the citizens of Georgia, and we were precluded to. We said it was out of order, and we couldn't do it. And it wasn't until Delta came out and said, you know, that they were going to cut ties with the NRA that I was able to kind of get several other of the senators rallied against this. The people of Georgia had their voice heard. And 30 minutes before the lieutenant governor tweeted that, he actually asked all the Republican senators if they were not going to support the Delta measure, and seeing that he could not force the bill through, then he decided that he was going to be against it. So again, okay. it's a political ploy on his part, but nonetheless, it's a real issue, because I don't believe in corporate welfare and capital cronyism.
All right, so the campaign is going on, and I get it if you say that Casey Cagle is a latecomer to this issue of the tax break, but what about the NRA? Senator, and its relationship with Delta Airlines. Do you think that this is a good thing, that because Delta has said no more customer discounts for NRA members, that the state should turn around and kill its tax break?
Well, again, let's be clear, Todd. Delta does not have the tax exemption right now. They are currently paying this fuel tax. And for them to come out during the weekend where, again, the Senate is discussing giving them a tax exemption, to say that they're not going to honor and continue their relationship with the NRA, that's just a slap in the face to all the conservatives and you know, people that love our country, people that love our Constitution, our Second Amendment. So, no, if they want to take that political position, then they're going to have to suffer the political ramifications of it.
Another thing that's a little bit confusing in this situation, and I realize it's a political time, and I realize that the NRA is popular with Republicans who are voting in this primary. I get it. Trust me. One thing that seems to be going on here, though, is politicians using the instruments of the state, a potential tax break, you know, the people's money one way or the other, to go after a corporation whose opinions it doesn't like. I understand if you think this is a swipe at conservatives, but using the people's money one way or the other to get back at them seems a little strange.
Well, I guess I have to disagree with the way that you're phrasing that, because this is not a punitive action. This is not us taking away a tax exemption that Delta already had. This isn't us going after Delta and saying, you know what, because you did that, we're going to take something away from you. Delta was asking the Georgia State Legislature to exempt them from a sales tax. They were asking for a favor. And in doing so, they took a dump on our conservative values. You can't ask us for something and then slap us in the face at the same time and expect us not to respond.
Senator, you have a 93% rating from the NRA as of October 2017. Why 93%? Why not 100? What happened?
You know, I was when you said that, I was thinking, what did I do wrong? I was expecting kind of 100%. I don't know the answer to that question. I wish I did, but no, I was hoping to be 100%.
And have you received any financial backing campaign money from the NRA or any of its PACs there in Georgia?
I love this question because the answer is absolutely no, I have not.
The NRA, according to our research, gave $15,000 to the Georgia GOP. Have you gotten any of that money siphoned to you for any of your races?
No, I have not received any money from the Georgia GOP.
Well, there's some other news that affects Georgia, Senator. Dick's Sporting Goods says today that they're no longer selling assault-style weapons at all or high-capacity clips. They won't sell a gun to anyone under 21, regardless of local or state laws. This takes effect immediately. Here's another corporation taking a position on guns. They have 10 stores in the state of Georgia, as I'm sure you know. What do you think?
Again, if that's the position that Dick's Sporting Goods wants to take, by all means, I don't think as an elected official, as government, that we need to interfere in what their policies are. But at the same time, remember, Dick's Sporting Goods is not coming and asking us for any type of tax exemptions. They're not asking a favor from us. So if that's what they want to do, by all means, that's within their power.
Senator, I know at the top of this interview you might have sensed, I don't know, a little bit of the confusion that I have about this whole situation, because Delta has decided that a business relationship it has with the NRA basically isn't worth its money. These are corporations, you know, that are in business to make money. And it doesn't seem to me that that really affects anyone in Georgia's right to buy a gun, to support the Second Amendment. You can go out to any sporting goods store today, not Dick's Sporting Goods, I guess, but another one, still buy your weapons, regardless of what some airline has to say about a private organization. I guess I'm missing the connection.
Yeah, let me try to explain it one more time. Like you mentioned earlier, we in the state of Georgia, whenever we start dealing with tax collections, we are dealing with the money that belongs to the people of Georgia. It's not technically the state's money. They're taking it from the people of Georgia. And if the people of Georgia do not want to give Delta a tax exemption, why should we force that on them? Again, this whole uprising is because the people of Georgia, again, those people that love their Second Amendment, love our country, they have reached out and they have made their will known to their representatives. This is how representative government works. The people in Georgia do not want their tax money going to an organization or a company that fights what they believe in.
Well, a tax break for Delta Airlines may be on the way out in Georgia. Senator Michael Williams is running for governor on the Republican side. Senator, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
You're listening there to teachers protesting over the last few days for better pay and benefits in West Virginia. A statewide strike has closed down every single public school in West Virginia since last Thursday. Finally, last night, an agreement and a promise of a 5% pay raise for teachers. So teachers, for now, are set to return to classrooms tomorrow. Jake Jarvis is a staff writer for the State Journal. He's been on the story from the Capitol in Charleston.
From the beginning, teachers have complained about their low wages, their health insurance, and a couple of other different education issues working in the legislature, some charter school stuff, education savings account. But the big two issues has been their pay and their health insurance. They've said that they can deal with having lesser pay than other teachers, but for years, their health insurance was a great benefit. So as that benefit decreases, it's hard to see where they're getting their money's worth.
So what did teachers get here? I mentioned a 5% pay raise. What does that mean for the bottom line for teachers?
Right. So a 5% raise will be about $2,000 extra for every teacher, and then also some money that's included in the salary schedule as a teacher gets experience. But teachers haven't really gotten anything on their insurance right now. So teachers have asked for a long-term fix to their insurance, and right now we just have a task force that's supposed to come back and look at the problem and see if there's a long-term solution. We didn't really hear anything extra on that, and so I'm hearing that teachers aren't super happy with this deal because it doesn't have a fix for their insurance. So they just have the extra $2,000 a year.
And they've got a deal with the governor. Is it clear that the state legislature will approve this deal and that it'll go through?
It's actually not clear that the deal will go through. The deal is based off the governor finding $58 million extra in revenue. And this extra revenue, when we asked where it came from, he just pointed to a couple of different things like the Republicans' tax overhaul last year and his own plan to help roads in the state with a road bond. So it's really not clear where that money's coming from. And we've already seen leaders in the legislature questioning if that $58 million is actually there. And if it's not there, they want to be fiscally conservative and try to shepherd the state's resources as best as possible. So I think it'll be a tough sell for lawmakers if they don't trust that that money's actually there.
Jake, we're going to be talking to a public school teacher from West Virginia in just a minute. But what have the last 4 days been like in classrooms across the state for kids?
Well, the last 4 days, classrooms have been empty. I mean, we've seen teachers filling up the state capitol by the thousands. I mean, more than 5,000 Thursday and Friday. And Tuesday, there was less people here, but the capitol's full. And I've seen lots of different teachers out in their own communities having picket lines and even some students joining them on the picket lines. And I think from the beginning, teachers have also worried about their students not being in school. So we saw a lot of teachers trying to make sure that students who rely on schools for meals and things, make sure that they have meals to take home on the weekends so that they don't go hungry. It's been pretty tense.
So, Jake, you mentioned that this deal has a 5% pay raise in the first year, I guess 2.5% in a couple of subsequent years, but no movement on the insurance costs. Do you have a sense that this is a deal that can last, or is there a chance that teachers will be right back here with the state in a year or two?
Well, I think actually we could be back here in a week. So this 5%, union leaders have said if this deal doesn't go through, that they will call their members right back out.
A deal between the state of West Virginia and its teachers to get teachers back in the classroom after a strike. Jake Jarvis says this is not yet a done deal. Jake is a staff writer for the State Journal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
About 20,000 teachers hit the picket lines in protest in West Virginia. Josh Nelson was one of them. He teaches English and Spanish at Huntington High School in Huntington, West Virginia. Josh, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what do you think of this deal between your governor and the unions that represent you and teachers and school support workers now?
Well, I can tell you that a lot of folks aren't happy. There are a lot of things that just haven't really been clarified yet. So, for instance, the governor says that teachers will receive a 5% raise, but based off of what? A teacher's starting salary, the average salary, our individual salaries, nobody knows. Nobody knows where that money is going to come from yet because, 2 days ago, there wasn't any money to do anything. But most folks with whom I've spoken are displeased because the raise was not our main focus. It never was. Our main focus was funding for PEIA, the public employee insurance. So every state worker, every public employee of the state of West Virginia has this insurance. So essentially, when this fight started, our main focus was and continued to be the funding of the insurance, because all of our deductibles and premiums were going to be affected, but to degrees that were kind of ridiculous. So, for instance, I, being someone who isn't married and has no human children, would be affected minimally, but my colleagues who had the audacity to marry and procreate would be paying, you know, upwards of like $460, $450 a month for coverage that would cost half that in any other fiscal year. So that was sort of our main issue from the get-go. And so on one hand, yes, we're very appreciative for the raise. That has also been sort of a long time coming, but nothing's in writing yet. It still has to pass the House and the Senate. And so far, President of the Senate, Mitch Carmichael, has not really been supportive of the announcement. So we'll sort of see how that goes.
Well, Josh, let me ask you how this is affecting the students. I mean, you've been out of the classroom since last week when this walkout started. What have you been hearing from parents and students, not only about the days of missed class, but about how the state treats teachers?
There's been more support than negativity as far as the parents are concerned, because, and I want to address this, because Senate President Carmichael, he sort of implied that we obviously weren't caring much for our students if we were willing to sort of walk out on them and all of this. And, you know, it is no secret that West Virginia is not a particularly wealthy state. And a lot of our students do depend on school for food throughout the year. And so I know that most counties around us did this. I can't speak for the whole state. But as soon as we knew that walkouts were going to happen, my community sprang into action. We bought so much food and stocked our pantries, and some of the teachers with whom I work sort of rallied their churches to pack and deliver, you know, food bags to our students who would need it. So we've been thinking about the kids from the get-go, because if all of these things happened as originally proposed, a lot of good teachers with whom I work would not be able to afford to stay. So as far as the students are concerned, I know that a lot of parents are ready for them to be back in school. We've been ready to go back into the classrooms, but there's also been a whole lot of support from our students.
Well, Josh, the news is that the deal is set between teachers and the governor, and teachers are heading back to the classroom on Thursday. Are you heading back?
As of now, I'll head back. What sort of spooks us the most was, you know, yesterday, the president of the WVEA, one of the unions, mentioned, you know, we reserve the right to call you back out if things don't go through as planned. So right now, the unions and the governor have reached a deal, but nothing is in paper, nothing is passed either of the houses. So right now, it sort of just feels like the waiting game, but you know, who knows? I don't think they want to spill over into special session, and we certainly don't want to, you know, strike any longer than we have to. So as of now, yeah, I'll be back Thursday.
Josh, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Josh Nelson teaches English and Spanish at Huntington High School in Huntington, West Virginia. More of our continuing coverage now on the persecution of the Rohingya people in Myanmar. Around 700,000 Rohingya have fled Myanmar for neighboring Bangladesh in the last 6 months. They've been escaping brutal violence exacted by the Myanmar military, including murder, torture, and rape. The governments of Myanmar and Bangladesh have an agreement now to begin sending thousands of Rohingya refugees back to Myanmar. But experts and observers on the ground say conditions are not safe for them to return. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has put out a satellite image appearing to show that Myanmar authorities have razed at least 55 Rohingya villages to the ground. Farah Kabir is with us from Dhaka, Bangladesh. She's country director for Bangladesh for Action Aid, an international charity that's been assisting the Rohingya refugees.
As you know, it's 6 months since the influx in August, and initial few weeks, there were like thousands of them coming. It was pretty chaotic and mayhem, but now slowly with all different actors coming together, it's much more organized. But what I mean by organized is they are in 6 feet by 6 feet plastic sheet, bamboo framed camps, and it is extremely vulnerable and fragile, but just not possible suddenly to find places for 700,000 people in 2 months. These were little hillocks, and all these hills have been almost flattened to try and accommodate that many Rohingya refugees. The, you know, latrine, water, toilets, bathing spaces, sludge management, it's all a challenge. We are all trying with all the good intentions, but it is a huge, huge piece of work.
Farah, it's understandable that the government of Bangladesh wants to find an end to this crisis. They can't host 700,000 refugees forever. So there have been these agreements, we've talked about them on this show before, to start sending refugees back into Myanmar immediately, 6,000 or 7,000 already supposed to go. What's your view of how feasible this is, how safe it is for people to return now?
Well, obviously, from the point of the government, they would want to repatriate. And I think people from Myanmar, Rakhine states, want to go back to their home. But there is this whole discussion that it is still not safe, because even last week, 500 Rohingya refugees came across the border. So unless it is safe, unless there's an enabling environment, I don't think that the refugees are going anywhere.
As these discussions continue, Farah, is there any monitoring or accountability being discussed here? 6,000 people to go back immediately. Will anybody be watching to make sure that they're just not going back into the fire?
Well, that's the problem, because Bangladesh government had asked for multilateral, you know, involving UN agencies like UNHCR or other relevant agencies, but the Myanmar government's not agreeing. And this is where international leadership has to come in, that this must be monitored. It must be safe on that side for any one of them to return. They're so traumatized. And the violence that they have suffered, it's unbelievable.
Farah, can you share some of the stories of Rohingya women that you've come into contact with? You're managing a huge refugee facility at Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh.
Well, you know, it is so sad that in this day and age, we are seeing such gruesome violations. I have spoken to many, and they have told us about being raped, about being harassed, how their children were taken away from them, all sorts of different kind of extreme measures were taken so that they had to leave. They have walked for miles, they walked for 10, 15 days. They gave birth on the way. Then they gave birth after they came to the camp. And it's such a sensitive issue. They're so traumatized. You just can't barge in and start talking about it. So over a period of time, we have managed to develop some trust, and they have shared. Children were taken away from them, the girls, their sisters, raped in front of them, the men taken away, being shot. So you, all that you have either read or seen in movies is actually happening down there.
I mean, the impact on the people that you're helping to care for must be unimaginable. If they're safe now, at least in tents with bamboo frames, the damage emotionally and psychologically has to be overwhelming.
Absolutely. I mean, who would want to become a refugee? Who would want to live in a 6 feet, 7 feet plastic room? You know, it must be when you have no other option, no choice. You have to be that desperate. And that's the situation with the Rohingya refugees. When we spoke to them, they said, at least we can sleep here. The initial reactions were, we feel safe. Now, as time is moving, they're getting very edgy. They feel the uncertainty. They don't know what the future holds for them. They really don't know what's that going to be for them tomorrow. So that initial sense of feeling safe and comfortable is now being taken over by uncertainty. Where are we going to go? Who are we going to be? Where do we belong? All these questions are coming up. And it's particularly difficult for the children. I mean, I'm so upset that these children almost belong to no one. They're stateless, because the Myanmar government had stripped off their parents, the adults, of citizenship since 81, 82. And now these children have come over or were born here. Where do they belong? Are they Myanmar nationals? Are they Bangladeshi nationals? It's not possible for Bangladesh to suddenly give them nationality and citizenship. So that means their future is at large. And there's no education. They are just living on a subsistence level from one day to another. This cannot continue. It's already 6 months.
And what does the government of Myanmar want at this point after doing so much to terrorize these people and drive them out into Bangladesh? It seems to me they would be happy to have them stay next door.
Well, Todd, they obviously did not create this situation with the intention of taking them back. I'm sorry, I'm being skeptic, but I have seen no measure, no action, no gesture which suggests that the Myanmar government is welcoming them back.
Farah Kabir is country director in Bangladesh for Action Aid, speaking to us from Dhaka in Bangladesh. Farah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Thanks for being with us this hour on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. You know that old saying, laughter is the best medicine? It isn't. But that doesn't mean it doesn't work at all. There is some evidence that it might help.
Humor is important. When you're finding things funny, it does these wonderful things for you of shifting your perspective. It has cardiovascular effects. So I think that these findings, I hope that they are part of a new wave of research on humor and its possibilities for happiness and for health.
That is psychologist Dr. Belinda Campos. She's part of this week's episode of The Science of Happiness. We visit with the Science of Happiness podcast every week to try out a different happiness exercise, training the brain to help you be just a little bit happier. Well, this week we're looking at the three funny things exercise. So the idea here, of course, is pretty simple. At the end of the day, write down three funny things that happened to you or that you saw, and then reflect on them. Dacher Keltner is the host of The Science of Happiness, and he says you have to go for three because one laugh just isn't enough.
In large part, you need three funny things because, you know, laughter and mirth and amusement is one of the great human achievements. And regrettably, you know, work by Robert Provine and other people who have been interested in humor and laughter shows, you know, we're kind of living lives where we lose sight of the absurd and what's funny and what's worthy of laughter in our lives. You know, one of my favorite findings in the laughter literature, just to justify why we should practice three funny things, is, you know, there are studies that show that little kids laugh, you know, dozens, hundreds of times a day. And a middle-aged adult like me might laugh once every 10 days. And it's one of these existential laughs where your life is falling apart, you know. So I feel in the science of happiness, one of the most underappreciated virtues is humor and mirth and funny things.
Well, your guinea pig for this week, Dacher, is James Cleveland. What's James's story?
James is a fascinating guy. You know, he had this high-powered job and kind of was out in the woods early in his life. And he realized, like, he was working too hard. He was losing touch with his body. He was traveling all the time. And he wasn't doing what he really wanted to do in the world. And so he made this big transition where now he runs this program that gets kids who often don't get a chance to get outdoors, to get outdoors, enjoy the benefits of nature. And the other thing he realizes, he wanted a family. He wanted to have kids who are not only the great source of conflict in life, but also funny things.
Not every moment is funny in my day, but what I'm discovering that even during a long, hard day, there are moments of happiness to pay attention to. I started to see patterns, like the patterns of my funny moments are about my family.
And this is what's so poignant about the episode is one of his funny things is this exchange he has with his daughter where she dresses up as in kind of royal garb and calls James a queen.
I don't know if kings have wands.
No.
Am I a queen or a king?
A queen.
I'm a queen?
Oh, a queen.
I'm a queen. And you're a princess?
Yeah, with a star.
With a star wand? And cookies?
Yeah, cookies. No, I hold the cookies while you're a king, Daddy.
Oh, so I'm a king again. Great.
And what's really wonderful about that observation is, you know, we know that play and humor is fundamental to in the development of the child, right? So young kids start playing with words at 18 months. They start taking on dramatic characters at age 3 or 4. They become princesses and dragons and gladiators and so forth. And those capacities for play and humor and mirth not only teach them how to handle stress and to connect and collaborate, but they teach kids how to perspective take and think about other people's perspectives and find empathy. So it was a really wonderful moment in James's description.
Well, every episode, Dacher, has your expert scientist to come on and explain a little bit of the psychological or even the neuropsychological phenomenon that's behind all this. Dr. Belinda Campos joined you. She's a professor of psychology at UC Irvine. Dr. Campos says that some scientists in Zurich took the three funny things exercise and put it to the test. What did they find?
Well, you know, a lot of these happiness practices are really ways of rethinking a day, of sort of framing an interaction. And in Zurich, Willibald Rook and colleagues had people do this three funny things, where they just sort of think about three funny things, and they found that it improved well-being, right, compared to the right control conditions.
Yeah, so the study was really interesting. It examined five different humor-based activities, and what the authors were interested in studying is which of these interventions seemed to have the most pronounced effect on happiness, both, you know, immediately thereafter, short-term effects, as they call them, and up to 3 to 6 months later. And so one of the things that they were able to find is that the three funny things was consistently the most potent indicator of happiness changes all the way 6 months after the intervention.
What does it do for us when we laugh, when you throw your head back and you really feel it from the belly? Yeah, it feels good. I think we all know that. There's a reason why comedy is a multi-billion dollar industry. What's it doing for us mentally? What does it do for us in the brain?
So what we know from the laughter studies is that when you laugh, you exhale deeply. You never laugh. And you inhale. It doesn't even sound like a laugh. And when we exhale deeply, it actually calms the stress-related regions of your sympathetic autonomic nervous system, which elevate blood pressure and heart rate and the like. So it calms your body. The other thing that scientists have been really interested in is laughter kind of puts you into this cooperative state. And there's studies that show my laughter is contagious, spreads to other people. My laughter kind of creates this context with other people where we're saying, let's collaborate or cooperate or take things lightly.
I think that this has been really understudied. In other studies that we've done, we find that humor, for example, shared humor, makes people feel closer than if they have the same experience by themselves. We find that humor is linked to psychological well-being. The studies of others have shown that humor helps you recover faster in terms of cardiovascular activity or after stress. So I think that these findings, I hope that they are part of a new wave of research on humor and its possibilities for happiness and for health.
Gosh, Dacher, I don't know. You know, I've always thought of myself as sort of the ham among some of my friends. They would probably disagree, frankly. They all think they're the hams. I feel like I'm the most valuable player in my friend group now because I'm always making everybody laugh. I do great impressions, by the way.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting. We did this one study that Belinda was part of. You know, we looked at, like, when you get around with your friends, you get into groups, you start telling funny stories. And you may even be joking about each other and embarrassing each other. It doesn't seem like it's that consequential, right? And yet it's one of these powerful human universals when we get together friends around a campfire, you know, we go out to a bar, whatever it is. And what this research that Belinda's been part of is there is a lot of gravitas and benefits to having hams in your midst, right? When we laugh together, we calm down. When we laugh together through the imitations and funny stories, we feel a sense of common cause and camaraderie. We feel like we're part of a stronger group. And so part of the message of the three funny things is there are actually really serious sides to humor and laughter that we shouldn't lose sight of. It's good for the body.
Dacher Keltner is professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and host of the Science of Happiness podcast, co-produced by the Greater Good Science Center and PRI. Dacher, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Happy talk, keep talking, happy talk.
Well, you can find information on all of the happiness exercises that we've covered on The Takeaway, along with instructions if you want to take part at home. It's all on the website at thetakeaway.org/happiness. I told Dacher there that I'm pretty good at impressions. And sometimes, if you want to make your friends laugh, you have to give them a good impression of the people you cover. Thanks so much for listening. Have a happy Wednesday. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Talk about a bird learning how to fly. Maybe. making all the music he can make.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.